I've been in Rome for 3 weeks, and all I've done is learn a few Italian words and eat.
You feel guilty because you are American. You don't know how to enjoy yourself.
I beg your pardon?
Americans. You work too hard. You get burned out. Then you come home and spend the whole weekend in your pajamas in front of the TV.
That's not far off, actually.
But you don't know pleasure. You have to be told you've earned it. But an Italian doesn't need to be told. He walks by a sign that says, you deserve a break today. And he says, yeah, I know. That's why I'm planning on taking a break at noon to go over to your house and sleep with your wife.
We call it dolce far niente. It means the sweetness of doing nothing. We are masters of it.
Dolce.
Dolce far niente.
Dolce far niente.
It's Britney, bitch.
And I rock everywhere like Sasha.
I'm supposed to be the franchise player, and we're in here talking about practice.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
Out, Charlie! Out!
Our next door neighbors are foreign countries.
I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
Alrighty, welcome back to Remember Shuffle. We have a bit of detour for you today. We are wanderlusting into the unknown on today's episode. As a pod today, we're going to find out who we are. We're going to find out who we are, why we're here. And we've brought to you, listeners, a sacred text. A text from which all 21st century middle-aged American women draw power. I'm speaking, of course, of eat, pray, love. Before we could live, laugh, love, we had to eat, pray, love. And this is quite possibly the most American book of the 21st century. The 19th century had Moby Dick. The 20th century had The Great Gatsby. And I truly believe, I'm calling it, that this is the defining book about American philosophy in the 21st century.
Yeah, you might think, who remembers Eat, Pray, Love? Who saw this movie? Who read this book? But let's look at its impact. Let's look at, in 2019 or 2020 or thereabouts, there was a new term that graced the internet, a little thing called the Karen. A Karen, as we all recall, is an upper middle class white woman who is not good at being in a society. She selfishly belittles people in service positions and asks to speak to the manager about every little inconvenience. A Karen is privileged and rarely thinks about others. Or the much more serious transgression of calling the police on black people when they walk their dogs in the park. The Karen was so unpopular that not a single new baby in the United States was named Karen in 2020. They broke the language. Now, the Karen was also associated with a certain aesthetic. Little signs in your kitchen that say live, laugh, love in their suburban houses, and a halfway understood pseudo-Eastern spirituality, a kind of yoga-adjacent mindfulness. And Eat, Pray, Love, the book and movie we're talking about today, it didn't spawn the Karen. It didn't give us the Karen. There's no causal relationship there, but it does appear to be a major cultural touchstone for a kind of suburban wine mom or Karen type of figure. The Karen is defined by their selfishness, their comfort, and their self-actualizing come before anything else. And that is an ideology that is well represented by Eat, Pray, Love. Even if in the film, this kind of selfishness is portrayed in an entirely positive light. And we're also doing it because Remember Shuffle is going international. We got not one, but two genuine Italians on our podcast today. Two very good friends of mine. Please say hello, Francesca.
Ciao.
And Andrea.
Hi, everybody.
Francesca is a good friend of ours who is returning to the mother country, returning to Italy. Maybe she'll find herself there. And we wanted to get her on the pod as one of our two experts.
And I think the strongest part of this movie is the part that takes place in Italy. It's the only part that has a coherent ideology to it. And Andrea, I would say you're a fairly like proud Italian man.
Why'd you say that?
Just your opinions on literally anything. But so I'm so eager to hear what you think of this movie's portrayal of Italy and the Italian people.
So first of all, I'm really thankful to be here because otherwise I would have never had the chance to watch such a awfully terrible movie from any perspective you want to take it. It's really disgusting. Well, there is a lot to unpack. There is that kind of general literary device when it comes to American depictions of Italy. This kind of country which basically doesn't exist. It dwells in the realm of dreams, right?
Yes.
There is no real people there, right? just these swarthy, elegant, or always horny men roaming on the streets and slapping women's asses. That kind of primordial representation of Italian masculinity. And I got to confess that I'm flattered by that. But there is something that she says. Every American woman goes to Italy to get pasta and sausage.
Yes.
And that's true. There is a whole thing. Growing up as an Italian boy, yeah, we know that, especially female tourists come to our holy motherland precisely for that reason.
It's even funnier in the book because within the first maybe 20 pages, I think she describes meeting one beautiful Italian man, Giovanni, and finding out that this beautiful Italian man has a beautiful twin, identical twin, I think Giuseppe, Giovanni Giuseppe. And she immediately fantasizes sleeping with both of them. Like, this woman is so horny. And again, the movie should have had the courage to portray this.
What did you think of the movie on the whole, Francesca?
Amazing. No, I'm kidding. Actually, it's really hard for people in their early 30s, women living a decent life, but not being upper class. It's really hard to actually sympathize with her. I hated her from the very beginning of the movie, and I hated her throughout the entire movie, so I didn't like it, honestly. And she's a selfish prick who just wants to do whatever she wants to do in each of the countries that she visited without even actually trying to embrace the cultures. She wants to see Italy as a place where you only eat and there's la dolce vita, il dolce far niente. And that's what she wanted to see. But since she wanted just to see that, that's how the movie was. Through her eyes, that's how Italy is, or India, or Bali as well.
Franca, sorry, but I gotta stop you. Like, you said dolce far niente. Well, it is actually dolci far niente.
Sorry. All right. You're right.
And Franca, the actual author, the movie aged up the character into Julia Roberts, who's in her early 40s. In this film, but in real life, this woman was so rich and privileged at 32 years old. That's when she did all this shit. Imagine how much less sympathetic she would be if it was a fucking 32-year-old doing all this shit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so let's just talk a little bit about our beautiful author, Elizabeth Gilbert. She believes that writers should find stories not in the seminar room, but by investigating the world. So she worked a bunch of exciting jobs in her youth, including at a bar. It's funny, I've told this story to so many people who live in New York, and they've had no idea. Have you guys ever heard of the movie Coyote Ugly? It's about a tabletop dancing bar. It's a very popular movie. It came out in like 2000. This is written by her and her own experiences working at an East Village bar called Coyote Ugly, the bar on 14th Street, which everybody passes and figures, oh, that must be a different Coyote Ugly, not the setting of that movie, because nobody I know has ever been there. So.
I live blocks away from it. I walk by it almost on the daily, and I was like, oh, that must be a bar that was started because of the movie, but no.
So she writes about her experiences as a bartender, makes a bunch of money off of it, and marries a gentleman that she meets while working at that bar. And then this is where the plot of the movie takes off. It's very much an autobiographical story from the point of old Karen, whatever her name is.
Elizabeth Gilbert. Lizzie Gilbs tells you precisely what she's thinking. Every asinine thought or feeling that enters this woman's head, she puts to page. She sounds like she was cool at one point. If she was up there dancing on tabletops in the 90s in New York City, that's pretty cool. But yeah, she gets rich off of her Coyote Ugly work, and then that getting optioned into a movie. And the thing that you need to know about her is that she, and the movie gets into this a lot, she's one of these people who thinks that she is a love addict. She wrote a piece called Confessions of a Seduction Addict, in which she wrote that she, quote, careened from one intimate entanglement to the next, dozens of them, without so much as a day off between romances. She acknowledged, seduction was never a casual sport for me. It was more like a heist, adrenalizing and urgent. I would plan the heist for months, scouting out the target, looking for unguarded entries. Then I would break into his deepest vault, steal all his emotional currency, and spend it on myself.
Yeah, this woman sounds like a lot of fun.
But yeah, she is not a good writer. I read 10 to 20% of this book in preparation for the pod, and this woman should be forbidden from using metaphors. As her marriage fails, she describes herself and her husband in their state of shock as having, quote, eyes like you see in refugee camps. She called her failing marriage an internment camp of a marriage. Yeah, she compares her own divorce to 9/11 because it happened like 2 days before that fateful day. And she has all these little asides in the book about how insanely financially successful she and her husband are. They have a big house in the suburbs of New York City, and they have an apartment that they pay for in Manhattan. So when she's trying to make herself sympathetic about her brutal divorce, she's like, I had to move into the apartment we paid for in Manhattan. Fuck you! Especially since, like, this woman does spend a lot of time in the developing world. It's like, you should know not to compare your privileged struggles to fucking refugees.
Yeah, I don't understand. Why did it become so famous? Who started reading the book, watching the movie? Who was the public of all this?
Women in their 40s and 50s. Because there was another White Lady Divorce Italy movie in the 2000s called Under the Tuscan Sun that also came out right around this time. So I think the target is like women in loveless marriages.
Let's get into the plot of our beautiful film. Okay, so Julia Roberts is at a party with her friends, and on the way home, her husband tells her that he wants to go to grad school.
Boo.
And as soon as she is in bed, she breaks down crying immediately and prays to God in desperation. We are 5 minutes in, and it's the emotional low point of the movie. It is raining and thundering outside. Her life is crashing around her, and she is hoping that anyone is listening. Please, God, help me. And what has happened to her at this point? Her husband told her he wants to go to grad school.
Yep.
This is the most devastating news she has ever heard in her life. This is the moment when I knew we had to do an episode on this subject.
And it's important to stress, when she prays to God, God speaks to her and says, go back to bed, Elizabeth. And God speaks in her own voice, just to get an idea of the level of narcissism that we're dealing with here. Also, I do love that this movie, you got to give it its due, it does have the right opinion on graduate school. It should end marriages. And I can say that I have gone to graduate school, okay? Grad school is for people who are not good enough at life and needed more school.
When her husband of 6 years says to her, I'm thinking about going to grad school, and she responds with, I want a divorce. I was like, this is the greatest movie I've ever seen in my life.
Again, the book handles the divorce so much better, where she, it's understandable. I don't know why the movie made this choice. Maybe the director or screenplay writer, the screenwriters, maybe they went to grad school. It was catharsis for them to get it on the page, but the book stresses.
No, I don't think that's what it is.
No?
I think it's just that she needs to find herself, right? Her husband cannot be allowed to be in the same free fall-ish as she is. He needs to be a stable point of reference for her. He can't also be trying to discover who he is. That's her job.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Giordano, because everything is based on her ways of thinking, her ways of seeing everything. And so she doesn't even care what her husband actually does. What she cares is that she doesn't want him to go to grad school. That's it. It's all about herself, everything.
Him going to grad school is his version of traveling around the world for a year, eating and doing prayers.
And he wants to do it because at the party, he hears that the schools are struggling. He's like an admirable character. And it's like, no, fuck you. I'm not traveling enough in my job as a travel writer. And I just want to say, in the book, it's stressed that she's 32. She says she's been with this guy for 8 years, married for 6 of them. So the divorce is a lot more understandable. Okay, they got married too young at 24. And the big issue has to do with children, where he wants to have children. She's ambivalent about children. And it's implied that that's all wrapped up with like what kind of gender roles are going to happen in the marriage, where like it's implied that, you know, she's going to have to stay home and take care of the kids. This is so much more understandable than I refuse to be married to a graduate student.
So yeah, she's sad. She's having this breakdown where she speaks to God because her marriage isn't working, because her husband wants to go to grad school, and she's not traveling enough. This despite the fact that she just got home from being paid to go to Bali, and this weekend she's going to Aruba on a paid vacation. So, but it's not where she wants to go. She wants to go to Buenos Aires. Then she separates from her husband. She falls in love with an actor who is acting in a play about her.
Narcissist.
Played by the very handsome James Franco. And divorce proceedings are ugly, but very funny. This is, I think, the funniest part of the movie to me are like all of the scenes that involve her ex-husband representing himself in the divorce proceedings, singing a song, trying to enter a song in the legal evidence.
My client is simply not interested in a divorce.
Is he serious? Is he really representing himself?
One semester of law school, right here, baby. My client would like to submit a song that he wrote that he believes is relevant to these proceedings. It goes something like this.
Are you kidding?
Quitter, 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 quitter!
And then meanwhile, her and James Franco fall out of love. It happens very abruptly. Someone just comments that they started dressing the same. And she sort of notices that she repeats the same habits that she has in relationships, which is to always be with a man, always be defining herself by who she's with and not knowing how to be alone. So she decides to travel around the world. She speaks to God and God tells her, you need to go traveling. You need to figure out who you are. First, she goes to Italy.
Woo!
And her plan is to learn how to appreciate things in life. Someone tells her, Americans, they know entertainment, but they do not know pleasure. Italians don't feel guilty about doing nothing because they know they deserve it. There's a scene where she eats spaghetti set to Mozart, famous Italian classical composer, Mozart.
Yeah, there was no classical music written by any Italian that they could have used. No opera.
She learns to speak Italian, not with her words, but with her hands.
You don't speak the language just with your mouth. You speak it with your hands, gesti.
Like this?
Con i gesti.
I gesti.
Con i gesti.
Non lo so.
Ok.
Non hai capito.
He's a yelling.
Braccia, gesticolare. Com'è?
She says in the book that every city has a word.
One word. One single word.
Right. London's is dreary. New York's is ambition. And Rome's is sex.
Yeah, this is so fucking stupid. Every city, person, or concept can be distilled down into a single word. This person's job is writer. What the fuck? But let's get your take. I haven't been to Rome since I was 18 years old. Is Rome the sex city?
I don't even know what that means, to be honest. Like, I was quite I didn't know what to think. I mean, like, maybe. I don't know. If you read Roma backwards, it says amor. Mm. So maybe, like, being a writer, she may well be a highly educated and literate person. So she was playing with that. But, you know, there is something that makes me doubtful about that, you know?
So her plan in Italy is to learn Italian. So she takes a 4-month course in Italian at the Da Vinci School of Italian and learn how to appreciate food because, as she notes, she comes from a long line of Swedish and British Puritans who look down on pleasure, right? Americans, if they try and do something like watch TV, they feel guilty about it. It eats them up inside that they're not working. At least I will credit this part of the movie. It feels like the only part of the movie with any kind of ideology. It's actually prescriptive. It's saying that you shouldn't feel guilty and then binge with pleasure.
Yeah, what she says about America is correct. What she says about Italy, not, but what she says about America, like, you work too much and then you binge and like you're so burnt out from the week that you spend the entire weekend just eating breakfast cereal in front of this TV like a shell-shocked fucking trench veteran of World War I. That is correct. That is all objectively true, backed up with science and facts and logic.
Highly informed by a vague notion of Orientalism, which, yes. You know, we were saying earlier, this depiction of Italy in American media, especially movies, it's a recurrent feature. I was thinking about another movie which was wildly popular in this country a few years ago, Call Me By Your Name by Guadagnino. I hope that he dies. And don't cut this. Like, I want this on the pod,
okay.
Right? Whenever you see these movies of usually wildly wealthy and fashionable Americans going for one reason or another to Italy, you almost never see actual Italians depicted as human beings, but they're mostly stock characters.
Sex-crazed idiots.
Yeah, right. You know, stock characters in the, you know, Athenian comedy style, right? And so they don't really have agency, personalities that you can't tell an Italian apart from another within these movies. They're all the same thing. And that happens with Guadagnino. May God fucking destroy him. She claims that she studies Italian. And you can say that she's really proud of it when she basically orders from the menu. Yep. I mean, like, what sort of linguistic skills do you need to have to do that, right?
Yeah, it's like week one of any language course, ordering how to order food at a restaurant.
It's one of the most pat on your own back moments of the movie is when she reads her order from the menu. Reading in Italian is not particularly difficult because there are no exceptions. Everything is said exactly how it's spelled. And so it does seem particularly funny. Let's do the
Orientalism.
Let's do that part now.
The movie is divided up into thirds, like Jordana said. First she's in Italy, then she goes to India, then she goes to Bali. And she plans it this way because she's going to learn pleasure in Italy. Then in India, she's going to learn devotion, the prey, so like not about pleasure. And then in Bali, she's going to learn to balance the two. And that's what turns into love. That was her plan. And so when you look up this film on Wikipedia, the first recommended article is Orientalism. Orientalism is the patronizing view of people from the East, capital T, capital E, and it's this exoticized, idealized one. So if the Euro culture you come from is puritanical about sex, then the Easterner is lascivious. If the Euro culture has a fucked up work culture, the Easterner is lazy. It essentializes and it flattens all these cultures from the East. They're static, they're unchanging, and you can define yourself in opposition to them. And what's so funny about this movie is that it hella does this for India and Bali, but also Italy. Italy gets lumped in with the exotic East in this film. And I think that the movie has such a weird portrayal. As we were watching it, there's a scene where they're in the barbershop, and this is where they describe, I can't say the Italian, whatever, fare niente. One of our beautiful Italians say it.
Dolce far niente.
Exactly. They're discussing that, and they're in the barbershop, they're doing the shave, they're discussing that. And I just looked at Giordano when they're describing the joy of not working, and I said, this film was financed by the European Central Bank and the German government. Trying to say, listen, that's just the way they are down there, you know? Nothing at all about, I don't know, the employment rate, youth unemployment rate in Italy, nothing about what the Northern Europeans have done to Italy or the banks or us forced austerity, nothing about that. No. They just enjoy it. They just enjoy not working down there. It's how they are.
It's basically the bare necessities song from the Jungle Book is what everybody's like in Italy, you know?
And yeah, even her view of the language, where like she learns it because she thinks it sounds so beautiful. And there's linguistic reasons that Italian sounds nice in terms of like, actually, I don't want to dork out about euphony on the podcast, about the combination of vowels and consonants or whatever, but she puts it up on this pedestal in the dumbest possible way. So the word, her favorite word in Italian is...
Attraversiamo.
Beautiful. Much like Lizzie Gilbs, that brought me to partial orgasm just now, where it's just this ordinary verb that means to cross over, and she uses it incorrectly. But she says it's the sounds, it's the, I forget the adjective she used, it's the lazy ah, or some shit like that. It's the rolled R, the consonants of yeah together, or whatever. It's like, Jesus fuck, lady. You clearly have never learned any foreign language in your life before.
Here's a quote from the book on how she describes speaking Italian and the way she puts it up on a pedestal. But I loved it. Every word was a singing sparrow, a magic trick, a truffle. I would slosh home in the rain after class, draw a hot bath, and read the Italian dictionary.
Disbaldo!
Porco Dio!
The words made me laugh in delight. I became one of those annoying people who say ciao. Just speaking these words made me feel sexy.
You know, there is a truth to that, probably, since, yeah, I know, like, you know, ordinary Italian, the language we speak, it's very different than English. You know, it is a language that was codified as a literary language, and then it became of common use. So there is surely something true to that. However, since this woman has claims to have been to Rome, I'm going to promise you, the diction of the Romans is quite harsh and terrible. Like, in a way, I mean, you know, I don't know if Rome is the city of sex. It surely is not the city of politeness and being gentle and kind, right? So I'm highly skeptical of that.
For sure. And yeah, she does mention, of course, the talking about standardizing through Dante, and she does talk a little bit about dialects in the book. But yeah, it totally doesn't match with her exoticized and idealized portrayal. And just, yeah, using this language as like a fucking totem for how she feels. Yeah, read some of these other quotes about the Italian language.
Yeah, so in her decision to study Italian, she says, why Italian? I mean, it would be more practical to learn the accordion, but why must everything have a practical application? Is this lifetime only only supposed to be about duty? Did my learning Italian need any justification other than it was the only thing I could imagine bringing me any pleasure right now? Just in case Italy invades Ethiopia again, you can brag about how you can speak a language spoken in two whole countries.
San Marino would like a word.
Yeah. And then this is about her class. She says, the interesting thing about my Italian class is that nobody needs to be here. Not one of us can identify a single practical reason to be in this class. Everybody, even the uptight German engineers, share what I thought was my own personal motive. We all want to speak Italian because we love the way it makes us feel. A sad-faced Russian woman tells us she's treating herself to Italian lessons because, quote, I think I deserve something beautiful in my life. The German says, I want to learn Italian because I love la dolce vita. Which, by the way, she made both of those people up. The fact that in her class happens to be a sad Russian woman and a uptight German engineer, she's just taking the first stereotype available about these two countries and is like...
Yeah, also, at no point does she ever mention, like, it would be cool to be able to speak with Italian people.
No.
Again, all about herself. Mm-hmm. What she wants to say, what she wants to see, what she wants to live. All about only herself.
Yeah, why she wants to speak to Italian is to say the words to herself around the house, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But it's just funny, something about the idea of learning a language being a panacea for all of your problems is so funny to me. I don't know that this is a realistic portrayal of learning a language for anybody, that it's like medicine.
No,
it's
not at all.
It's like work. It's tough learning vocab. And in the book, she even says, okay, she goes to Italy for pleasure, but she says she's going to be celibate, which, you know, okay, fine. That's
no sausage.
No sausage. And then she brags practically. She says, the only pleasure I was seeking was food and language learning. So she said she never went to a museum. She never, like, didn't look at art, didn't go to a museum, no opera, no music, no concerts, no culture outside of food and the most basic language learning.
Yeah, in the country with the largest number of UNESCO sites. Whatever, I guess. Right?
She does go to the Augustine.
Yeah, the mausoleum of Augustus.
Which she says has been like overrun with homeless people. But she says, this is sort of the emotional high point of the trip to Italy, is she notices that the mausoleum of Augustus has survived barbarian invasions, fascist takeovers, it being lived in by homeless people, and it's still there. And so she can still be there after, you know, a couple of breakups, which she finds very inspiring.
Yeah, so I don't want to psychologize too much, but can you imagine this random person comparing herself to the mausoleum of Augustus?
Like, I
would never dare to think of myself in such a way. You know.
Yeah, Andrea read my mind. I was about to say, the mausoleum of Augustus, the most important Roman emperor, like the biggest one. Also, the one remade by Mussolini to be his own mausoleum. This woman sees herself as the leader, as a fucking dictator, as the most important special lady.
It seems clear to me that we're dealing with a sociopath here, right?
Yes. Correct. Yes. Also, yeah, of all the old buildings she could have chosen in Rome, nothing but old buildings in Rome, she chose that one. Interesting.
By the way, this is a great joke. What did you guys think of this one? It's her first Italian lesson with her very handsome young Italian teacher, Giovanni, and he teaches her a word. I think it's attraversiamo.
Yeah.
And she goes, well, I'm going to teach you an American word now, because the pretense of their meeting up is that she's teaching him English. And she holds up the carafe of wine and says,
all right, let me teach you a word. Mm-hmm. Therapist. Therapist. It's good.
On.
You gotta learn your humor.
It's
good.
Not.
Come on, cheers.
Heyo.
Which is, yeah, truly one of the most American woman style jokes. I'm sure that this got the biggest laugh in the movie theater.
And with that line, 1,000 suburban alcoholic moms were born. I read a really depressing article several years ago on the CBC where there are entire meme pages on Facebook where the boomers live that called Mummy Needs Wine. And like this wine mom movement has spawned actual alcoholics. it's ruined lives. It's like, I just need a little bit. Mommy just needs a little therapy juice.
People joke about it all the time on Facebook, in the movies, and on TV. Moms need wine.
Laura McGowan was one of those moms. She and her friends got together regularly with their kids, and more often than not, the wine flowed freely.
It was like the joke. Like, the kids have the sippy cups, and we have our sippy cups. My Facebook feed
the memes that go around about wine and moms and drinking and moms.
But for Laura, that norm almost cost her the most important person in her life.
Eventually, I would have lost custody of my daughter. It was inevitable.
Laura hopes that society will get the message that parenting is a gift, not a burden that requires self-medicating.
I think it's a ship that's going to take a long time to turn.
But it's usually women needing the therapy with alcohol and eventually alcoholism.
And that's understandable, but I keep humble about it. I mean, I see the point of making it something, you know, to brag about.
Well, it's kind of another example of American consumption is not meant to be enjoyed. It's meant to fix your problems. You're not supposed to like your food. It's supposed to make you not hungry anymore.
Yeah.
That's why you're doing it. It's funny. It did ring true, some of what she was saying, because I read this part of the book while eating my sweet greens bowl at work. I decided that day that I was going to take a 5-minute lunch because I wanted to have more time working. And I read this part and I was like, okay, maybe this is a little true.
A lot of things are actually true. Yeah. I completely agree with Andrea about depicting American culture in the upper class.
Yeah.
Upper middle class.
It reminds me of a story my dad told me. My dad worked for Fiat and he would go over there for work sometimes and he would always complain about the people there. My dad is 100% Italian, by the way. His parents came here from Italy and he was like, these fucking Italians, man, every time it's lunchtime or it's coffee, we got to take a big break for half an hour while everybody eats. Nobody wants to work through lunch. And I'm like, you know, you're the sucker. Yeah, you're the guy who needs to die for his company.
But let's circle back to the plot, wrap it up real quick. We're going to spend most of our time on Italy because it's the most entertaining. And I just think, like, visually, it's the best part of the movie. I love the shots of food, man. I could watch Julia Roberts eat pasta amatriciana.
But the part where she's watching a couple make out while she eats the pasta is very good, I thought.
Yeah, so, yeah, another thing. I watched the movie together with Franca, and she made me notice that basically, like, every time they are out on the street, there are people making out in a very lustful way. I'm like, what are you trying to, you know, implicate, you know?
No, the absence of the puritanism, basically.
Yeah.
So the fact that we just do whatever the hell we want to do, even on the street, and she wants to see that as an opposite of how she lived. But another, really, really sad way of picturing Italy.
It's very weird because New York City is not the most puritanical city in the world. Like, and I'm saying this as an Italian, like, you know. It's not the first place that comes to my mind when I think about prohibition regarding lifestyles or expressing yourself. So I don't know whether I've lived in the same city as, you know, Liz. You know?
Well, it's like you said, she's projected a version of Italy already in her mind. And that's the version that's going to be there when she shows up.
Exactly.
Also, the book makes clear she's so fucking horny in the book. It makes clear she thinks that Italian men are more beautiful than Italian women.
Yeah. So. It's Roman specifically. She says that Rome is the only city in the world where the men are more beautiful than the women.
She wished.
I really like the scene which is a scene made up for the movie where her and her friend are enjoying pizza at the best pizzeria in the world, because it's the best pizzeria in Naples, which she figures must be the best pizzeria in the world. And her friend is like, I can't eat any of this. I've gained 10 pounds since I've showed up in Italy. And Lizzie Gilbert reprimands her friend and tells her, you know what? Life is meant to be enjoyed. Men will have sex with you either way. What we're going to do, we're going to eat this pizza. We're going to buy bigger jeans. And then she goes to the store and spends 5 minutes trying to get her jeans on with some kind of zipper contraption. I thought the point of you being here is you're buying bigger pants. Why are you trying to squeeze into these small low-rise jeans?
Yeah, but Giordano, it's a Hollywood movie, so like you can get like a little bigger, but you don't want to get fatso pants, you know? Also, I gotta stress, one of the fucked up things about this scene, there's an entire conversation about women's bodies and body issues where they talk about muffin tops. Again, it's yada 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 away with, as long as men are willing to have sex with you, you can feel good about your body, right? Get all your validation externally. That's the only thing that counts. But the most fucked up thing about this scene is that in the book, there is none of this. Both of them eat two pizzas in the pizzeria. Don't feel guilty. Don't think about it. No conversation. No no bit about buying more jeans. But because it's a Hollywood movie, we have to add a little bit about body issues. We have to a little bit and get that comedic genius of two women pulling up jeans on the floor of a clothing store. It's such dog shit.
First, I completely agree with you. It really made me mad when they were speaking about you don't have problems with getting men even if you have that muffin top, but that shouldn't be the point. And then second, they all talk about the fact that you shouldn't care about having muffin top because men still want to have sex with you. And then you go to the store and you still try to fit into that aesthetics that you need to be fit. That really made me mad again. I was mad the entire movie.
So
we'll go over to India next, where she goes to pray. This is the pray part of the Eat, Pray, Love.
Yes. Here, she's going to try and learn devotion. She does chores. She scrubs the floor. She tries to meditate. She sucks at it. She meets a recovering alcoholic who gives her the worst nickname of all time, groceries, because it's implied she eats a lot, I guess.
It's one of the weakest nicknames I've ever heard in my life. Yeah, she's eating at dinner. And he's like, oh, groceries over here, which that's not even the word for food. It's a separate word. And so for the rest of the time, he calls her groceries. It's a very much like a Andy Bernard Big Tuna style nickname.
And we try and get some like emotional resolution where in India, it said she needs to learn to forgive herself. And it's like, man, but it's the movie. I'm going to use a modern word that's on the internet a lot. The movie is totally gaslighting you because in the movie, she did nothing wrong. It's her dick husband who blew up the marriage by going to graduate school. But for some reason, she has to forgive herself. And then she has a fantasy where she imagines talking to her husband, and that leads to her forgiving herself. And it reminded me, like, in Alcoholics Anonymous, in the program, apparently, there is a step where you need to forgive yourself for your fucking up your life by drinking too much and being an alcoholic, but it is in conjunction with having difficult, uncomfortable conversations with all of the people you hurt and wronged in your past life as an alcoholic. And this movie is just the first bit, or rather, you can imagine the difficult conversation and, you know, that counts. You're good. You did your due diligence.
Yeah, just imagine how this conversation would go, which is exactly what she does with the other conflict in India, which is her work partner at the meditation center who's getting married.
Yes.
In an arranged marriage, and she doesn't want to be married. And her solution to her problem is just to imagine her having a happy life and then say, I imagined you having a happy life. And the child bride says, oh, thank you so much. That makes me feel so much better.
Yeah.
End of the conflict.
Yeah, it is some comical white savior shit, which we'll unpack in our themes more in full. But there's an arranged marriage with a fucking teenager. She obviously can't change it. It's grounded in reality. So instead, she just says, you know what? Chin up there, bucko. I imagined you happy in your marriage and that'll work.
And it gets back to what we said about Italy, where you can just have a projection of how things will go. And then if you just imagine that to be true, you're writing the story before you even live it. And then you can be like, yeah, man, I fixed a lot of shit over there.
It's terrible. And yeah, it's worth stressing. The only, like Franca, I was mad almost the entire time while watching this movie. The chunks in Italy are at least visually appealing, and there are a couple laugh lines and some beautiful shots of Italian buildings and Italian food if you just watch around the characters and the things they're saying and doing. But the chunks in India and Bali are so fucking boring. It doesn't work as a movie. It doesn't have like a good three-act structure. There's no emotional highs or lows. There's very little resolution because so much of it is just this lady just imagining things.
If this movie was just called Eat and it was about a woman going to Italy to learn how to enjoy life, it would have been a 3.5-star movie. But unfortunately, in India and Indonesia parts drag it down so much. By the way, one of the signs that she should go on this trip in the book is that all three countries she wants to go to start with the letter I, which reveals that she should be focusing on herself.
I.
Ooh. Ooh, that's a nice take.
Yes.
Yeah.
So yes, we move on to the third act in Indonesia, where she meets a 9th generation medicine man, who she had met at the beginning of the movie. He read her palm, made some predictions. I like to imagine this 9th generation medicine man is just a complete charlatan and con who cons white people out of their money with horoscope style predictions.
Based.
His predictions are usually, you will come back here and help me learn English. You will come back here and help me sweep the floors. You will help me do chores. That's what I see in your future. Which, respect, honestly. Yeah.
And the purpose of Bali, Indonesia is for her to find balance between the asceticism and devotion of India and the pleasure of Italy. But it's just, it's another Hindu place where she does more pseudo-Eastern meditation. And the, I guess the pleasure comes from the fact that it's filled with horrible global expats, digital nomads who have their beach parties or whatever the fuck in Bali. And this is where she breaks her own celibacy rule eventually. Here's where we get into like a traditional rom-com style thing.
Yeah, we have a meet cute, yes, where Javier Bardem almost runs her over with his car and has to bring her to a doctor. And Javier Bardem in this movie, by the way, as an aside, I was driving Ben nuts when we watched it because I could not take my eyes off of just the shape of his face and head. And I was telling him it's because, you know those, how we found like Neanderthal caves in Spain? That's that makes sense that they're in Spain because where whatever village he's from, I guarantee you that's where those caves were found because there is no one who looks more, he's got such a big face.
As we were watching, Trudeau was like, his features, they're so
deep set.
Deep set.
I'm not calling him unattractive. I'm just saying there's something about his big face. Hollywood, if you're working on a movie right now about a Neanderthal man, Javier Bardem is your man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not an expert, you know, a cinema expert, but he looks like he's the only good actor in the old movie. The role is pretty bland and banal. He's a kind of male counterpart to Lizzie, right? Was it the director who instructed them to act poorly? Because it really pains me to see James Franco in such a bad shape. I don't know much about Julia Roberts, but she's supposed to have been really good and important actor in the early 2000s, right? Awful, terrible. Disgusting. Like, you know, go back to acting school, I guess. Whereas at least Javier Bardem, okay, I can see that you're a professional, right?
Yeah. I don't think he phones it in this movie.
I didn't notice Julia Roberts was bad because like all Americans, I'm taken in by her smile.
And her laugh, but her staccato laugh.
And most of the movies that she played in are those romantic comedies in which that's all she had to do, basically show her sentiments and read and laugh and be pretty. So it doesn't really require that much of a tragedy way of acting, putting effort into expressing your feeling through acting. It's just like two feelings throughout your entire 25-year-old long career.
And so the movie ends with her almost growing, but then not, where the whole purpose of this was to discover herself outside of a man. So she finds a man and she throws herself into the man and she almost walks away and she goes back to her medicine man and the medicine man says, actually, you know, maybe you should go with him. And that's how the movie ends. Not with a bang, but with a whimper. Sexy whimper, though. You know what I'm talking about.
I love when Javier Bardem tells her that she will only be mentally well once she dates him.
And amazing.
And then she's like, that doesn't sound right. And then it goes to the medicine man, and the medicine man's like, oh, actually, yeah, he's right. And she's like, all right, well, I was externally validated into this, so I'm going back with
him. I love that because I've always done it with my girlfriends, you know. I mean, gaslighting is a form of art. And like, you know, yeah. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, I know that I'm not supposed to say things like this. And I like the way in which the way he managed to do so while at the same time showing his most emotional and sensitive self. He's my man.
I want to see Javier Bardem play this role exactly the same way he played his character in No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
With the creepy haircut. He comes up to Lizzie, he says, what's the most you've ever lost on a coin flip?
And she's supposed to have learned so much about herself that she can finally love again in a healthy way, which I guess she does. But do you guys want to take a guess at how this relationship ends?
Wasn't there a prophecy that she would have had a long match? Oh, yeah, but we don't know.
Yeah, this is the prophecy that she gets divorced, I guess is my point here. This marriage also does not last.
Which, you know, no shame, but again, the movie, no shame in getting a divorce, but the movie does posit this woman as some kind of sage. It reminds me of fucking Jordan Peterson, right? This alt-right, incel-adjacent psycho who writes his book 12 Rules for Life, mixing his fashy worldview with basic self-help stuff. Then he goes on, gets a benzo addiction, goes to Serbia for experimental treatment, eats nothing but beef, is put in a medically induced coma, and has the audacity to write 12 more rules for life. Motherfucker, you can't handle your own life. clean up your own house before you tell me your fucking rules. And that's Lizzie Gill bulbs here. It's like you had all of this money and privilege. You had a year to find yourself, and this is what you have to show. You're going to tell me how to find myself and stay married, you narcissist? All right, so as we always do, we've done our plot summary. Let's do our themes. And the first one, the one that needs to start it all, that we've been gesturing towards and dancing around, is of course selfishness, narcissism, and privilege. Because Lizzie Gilbs here is one of the least sympathetic protagonists to ever grace a silver screen, which is fine. You know, fucking Walter White isn't sympathetic, but I still enjoy Breaking Bad. What's galling about this movie is that it treats her as if she is sympathetic. It treats her as if she is relatable. And it treats her, worst of all, as if she's some kind of sage who's cracked the code of living a good life, and that she can give us advice on how to be happy, healthy, and whole. When it turns out, the key is to just be fucking wealthy. That's the key. That's the only thing she has to add.
Yeah, and I think it's very funny that the movie has aged up the character, because in the book, this is a story about herself, and she's, I think, 31 and 32 over the course of the book. And I think that this movie would have a very hard time pulling off this woman's journey as a rich 31-year-old woman who's finding out the keys to life. Imagine watching Lena Dunham do the things in this movie. The only way this movie gets away with it is by casting Julia Roberts, who can do a lot with a smile. She can do a lot of smoke and mirrors to the character by just giving you the America's sweetheart smile.
Yeah, like Franca said, the audience already knows her from all the rom-coms, so they're already filled with warm, fuzzy feelings, and they can project that onto this horrible character.
And it attracts a different audience. We can point this at the wine moms of America rather than someone in their 30s.
Okay, let's go around the room. Everyone say, what is the most egregious moment of selfishness or narcissism that this movie shows?
Well, there are many. I mean, the movie's about that. I'm deeply convinced that this is a movie about a sociopath. You know, you wouldn't see yes. such a dark character even in the most obscure Dostoevsky, probably. But when she's in India, this place where apparently you can get food poisoning or only diseases, that's what they talk about all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, India, basically a place where people pray and get sick. All right. When she talks to her friend, the one who has to get married unwillingly, right? I feel like, you know, we all know that this is a cultural and social terrible problem, right? This is a reality that affects people's lives for real. Her response doesn't even reply to that. She's like, oh yeah, I can see you happy.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ. I feel like not even Goebbels would be that. Yeah, like that cold-hearted as to not be moved by such a terrible thing.
You actually stole my idea what to say, because I picked that one. Given that also I'm a female, I really felt bad throughout that scene, because what she wants to see is finding love and being committed into a relationship. That's for herself. Whereas the girl, the Indian girl, she's forced into that, and she doesn't see that.
And she's scared. Right?
And she's scared. So the girl is scared, unhappy. She doesn't want to do it. But Liz is actually what she wishes it would happen to her own life. And so instead of projecting that girl's problems related to the arranged marriage, she just projects herself into that girl. And so that's the most, I think, that's one of the most narcissistic and selfish scenes of the entire movie.
Yeah, she makes it about herself. Even like in the scene of the wedding, everyone, like most people look happy, most people look dancing, or most people are dancing. The movie kind of yada 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 is over the problem, because of course Lizzie Gilbs has solved it. At this wedding, she can't even stay and like support her friend. She has to leave and think about her own failed marriage or whatever. Like everything, it always reduces to her.
And I think that's my point about her self-centeredness is the center of this movie. You just mentioned that she had to leave her friend's wedding because it reminded her too much of her own failed marriage. This happens throughout the movie. She goes to Italy to work on herself and learn how to become a better person. Then she goes to India to help pray and think about fixing her marriage. This whole traveling for her is like a prescription. And so it's a duty. It's something she has to do to fix herself. And it seems like it takes away from what she's actually supposed to do in Italy, for example, which is just to learn to enjoy doing nothing during the... That's not a task to check off and be like, I got the learn how to do nothing pin. It defeats the purpose of what she's trying to do. And then in India, when she's trying to learn how to meditate, it's like, if I just meditate hard enough, I'll fix my marriage or my feelings about my marriage. Well, that's, again, you can't be pointing meditation at a problem like that. That's not how life works, but it doesn't matter because she's already got it in her mind that this is what India is going to do for me. Yeah. What India is going to do for me is fix my thoughts about my ex-husband.
Her spiritual journey is sort of poisoned from the start by virtue of the fact that she is going to meditate and to Bali to have something to write about and publish a book that will make her even more wealthy. And so if that is the end goal, then it's hard to imagine that the type of spiritual healing that she is seeking is possible while also furthering, you know, a goal to financially benefit herself.
The most selfish and narcissistic thing she does is that on her last day in Italy, she forces the Italians to eat an American meal.
They love it. They love tacchino. That's what they love more than anything. If I've learned anything about this movie, Italians love American meals.
A fucking Thanksgiving feast. She forces the Italians to eat. And of course, like what happens for comedic effect is that one of these bumbling Italians forgets to defrost the turkey.
He's too horny. There's too many women around and he forgets.
Oh yeah, that's what he says. I forgot.
And his name is Luca Spaghetti.
Luca Spaghetti. Yeah. Andrea spoke earlier about Italians as stock characters in film, but I feel like this does happen all the time, is they're just the bumbling horny idiot. I know in the show Friends, it introduces like six Italian characters in the first couple seasons, and they're all horny idiots. Like between Joey Tribbiani, Paolo, and an Italian woman that Chandler gets together with and then leaves him. Hollywood does love to hit on this note quite a bit, and so does Lizzie. Moving on to, I think, the strongest theme that I think the book and the movie both share, which is religion. So Lizzie has discovered a new form of Protestant.
Take it again.
Lizzie has discovered a new form of Protestant. Lizzie has discovered a new form of Protestantism.
Lizzie Gilbert has discovered a new form of Protestantism.
Protestantism. Yes. This is her 95 thesis that she nails to the digital church door of the world. I think that this has something in common with something that Chapo Trap House has brought up a lot, which is that American Protestantism.
What is wrong with you?
Protestantism.
Hey, ESL speakers, say the word Protestantism for me.
Go.
Protestantism.
Protestantism.
Crushed it.
Protestantism.
Good. You know what? Close enough.
Anyway, she's formed...
Just say American non-Catholics.
She's formed a new form of American non-Catholic, non-Orthodox religion, which is focused on the self, the God, not a Catholic God. It's not even a Protestant God. It is you. You have become your own God. And the way that she treats a religion in this movie is truly fascinating. And I don't even have that much of a problem with it, but it's probably because I'm also a 21st century American. But the way that she treats religion is that you just pick whatever parts of whatever religions personally appeal to you. She even says at one point, I love Christianity and the things that it has to offer me, except for the part where it says you can have no other gods. She's like, that part doesn't matter.
Hey, does anyone remember their Sunday school? Does anyone remember which commandment that is? It's the first fucking one.
Yeah, so she goes to India. She's like, what does Hinduism have to offer me? She'll pick up beliefs from Norse gods, from Buddhism, from Christianity, from medicine men. She picks and chooses all these different parts of religion. And I'm always torn because inherently, I don't think there's that much wrong with this. If these things help her, in theory, it doesn't hurt anyone. But I guess where that sort of falls apart is that this book is evangelizing this spiritual approach to life. And I don't think that this is how non-American countries think about religion. I don't think that if you go to someone in Sicily or in Saudi Arabia and you say, we're choosing this one element of Catholicism or this one tradition of Islam and deciding that we're doing what's right for Allah or for Jesus, I don't think they would be like, oh yeah, that's fine. You can do a portion of the traditions and practices and get the benefits of religion.
I like to imagine her going up to a devout Muslim imam and being like, I love praying to God on the mat facing east towards Mecca, but 5 times a day? Could we get that down to 3? The dawn prayer is really a bummer. So I just, you know, I'd like to, you know, just get a little bit of it, just a little sampling.
And I love the idea of Lent, but 1 week, I think, it kind of gets the point across. You know, she's literally turned religion into a buffet.
Yes. A appropriate. It's the eating, praying, and loving movie.
It is the American approach. The true God is me, and then I can dress myself up in whatever way I want.
That's exactly the American society here on everything. Everything is commercialized and custom for the client to pick and choose whatever it fits best. Also religion. I think that the movie shows that, even though it's completely acritical about that, actually. Embracing that.
Yeah, bespoke religiosity in a way, yeah.
Even like the approach to mindfulness and meditation that this movie takes, it comes back to the narcissism and being the center of the universe. She is implied to be the specialist best meditator if she can just get over yourself. I won't lie, I've dabbled a little bit in mindfulness out of sheer desperation to make my thoughts and feelings go away. And what they tell you is that generally mindfulness and meditation is about focusing on your breath and passively noting your thoughts without judgment, because lesson number one is that you can't control your thoughts, that you can control your relationship to them. This is fucking stoicism and Buddhism and therapy. And this movie is so dumb that her friend who nicknames her groceries says, once you learn to control your thoughts, there'll be a void in your mind and the entire universe will rush in. You will be God. The universe will rush inside of you. And when she learns to meditate for a whole 20 minutes a day in the film, an elephant, the most majestic and regal of the mammals, comes to her and touches her with her trunk, or maybe his trunk, I don't know the gender of the elephant, at the climax of the India section. And yeah, it's wild. I mean, she is God. That's it.
Yes, God speaks to her several times in this book, and it's always in her own voice. And then she can begin to ask God for things. And so at one point, her husband won't grant her a divorce right before her trip is about to start. And so she writes a petition to God, which of course he grants. Yeah, she does refer to God as a he in the book. And her husband, out of nowhere, agrees to finalize the divorce.
Actually, I want to read just a few sections of this because this is the worst part of the book that I read. So divorce proceedings are going slowly. She writes a mental petition while she's driving in a car with one of her best friends. Her best friend is Lebanese and grew up during the brutal Lebanese Civil War. Bear all this in mind. And so her friend tells her to write a petition. I won't read it all. It's long and boring, but it starts, "Dear God, please intervene and help end this divorce. I recognize that you are busy with wars and tragedies and much larger conflicts than the ongoing dispute of one dysfunctional couple. But it is my understanding that the health of the planet is affected by the health of every individual on it."
So fucking true.
"As long as even two souls are locked in conflict, the whole of the world is contaminated by it. Similarly, if even one or two souls can be free from discord, this will increase the general health of the whole world, the way a few healthy cells in a body can increase the general health of that body." She says, "I read it to Iva," her Lebanese friend, "and she nodded her approval. I would sign that," she said. She was too busy driving to actually sign it, but she says, "No, let's say that I did just sign it. I signed it in my heart." And then Lizzie Gilb talks about all of the people who are signing this fictional petition to God to grant her a divorce. And they say, start naming names. And she says this horrible list. Her Lebanese friend says, "My parents just signed it. They raised their children during a war. They hate useless conflict. They'd be happy to see your divorce end." Lizzie Gilb says her Lebanese friend compared her own divorce to the Lebanese Civil War. She continues, "I closed my eyes and waited for more names to come. I think Bill and Hillary Clinton just signed it. Famous good marriage havers, Bill and Hillary Clinton. St. Francis of Assisi just signed it. Catholic saints really, really into divorce. Abraham Lincoln just signed it. And Gandhi and Mandela and all the peacemakers. Eleanor Roosevelt, Mother Teresa, Bono, Jimmy Carter, Muhammad Ali, Jackie Robinson, and the Dalai Lama. And my grandmother who died in 1984 and my grandmother who's still alive. And my Italian teacher and my therapist and my agent and Martin Luther King Jr. and Katharine Hepburn. And Martin Scorsese," which you wouldn't necessarily expect, but it's still nice of him. "And my guru, of course, and Joanne Woodward, and Joan of Arc, and Miss Carpenter, my fourth grade teacher, and Jim Henson." Sound off, everyone.
Her personal pantheon is so fucked up that I don't even know where to start.
I love that some people are actually impressive and some people sneak in there, like Jimmy Carter and Bono.
Yeah, I love that she's like Gandhi and Bono, some of the foremost peacemakers of the world.
To close up this horrible religion section, I have a pretty live and let live approach when it comes to, you know, your Eastern spirituality, mindfulness stuff, or prayer and religious stuff, so long as you're not a fucking bigot, you know, do your own thing. It might not be for me, but whatever. I have no patience, though, for nonsense crystal bunk. And if so, if something like tarot cards, that's the harmless weed of Crystal Bunk, this movie and book, this is the crystal meth of Crystal Bunk. Because here is the climax summary of the Eat, Pray, Love religion. In the end, I came to believe in something I call the physics of the quest, a force in nature governed by laws as real as the laws of gravity. The rule of the quest physics goes something like this. If you're brave enough to leave behind everything familiar and comforting, which can be anything from your house to bitter old resentments, and set out on a truth-seeking journey, either externally or internally, and if you are truly willing to regard everything that happens to you on that journey as a clue, and if you accept everyone you meet along the way as a teacher, and if you are prepared, most of all, to face and forgive some very difficult realities about yourself, then the truth will not be withheld from you. End quote. In conclusion, I don't know if there's a God, but if there is, God is sending this woman straight to hell. Fucking free fall down. In order to do the physics of the quest, you need to just have a lot of money and time.
The other thing that we'll talk about more on the Epic Bacon Reddit Guy episode is this idea that, like, if religion is going to die out, it's not because the epic atheists of the world will disprove it with facts and logic. It'll be because all of the practices of religion are taken up by Americans like Lizzie Gilbert, who practice them without any ecclesiastic connection. They are merely spiritual tools and have no dogmatic tradition in an organized religion. You know, you do yoga because maybe of its aesthetic attraction rather than any kind of like religious interest that you have in the practice. Same with meditation or fasting. If religion one day becomes less popular, it's entirely likely that we continue to do the practices involved in the religion, but we've just divorced them from a connection to a god or a deeper spiritual meaning.
So, okay, so just to wrap up on our final theme, we have the white savior narratives of this book.
Yeah, so we've already touched on these a couple times, naturally. It's not just that this woman's so up her own ass, but everywhere she goes, she solves people's problems. She immediately makes friends and immediately solves their problems. Like her Swedish friend who had body image issues, boom, solved. Solved with her knowledge bombs about how men will still fuck you even with a mush on top. The child bride who's scared about her relationship, boom, problem solved. I imagined you happy in my God center universe.
I sent you thoughts and prayers.
Or a horrible scene where there is a Balinese medicine woman who or traditional healer, different from the medicine man, who is also a divorcee and has a little daughter named Tuti, T-U-T-T-Y. And Lizzie Gilbes builds this woman a house by soliciting money from her rich friends and making a horrendous pun between the name of this Balinese girl, Tuti, and the Italian pronoun Tutti, meaning everyone, and about how everyone needs to help or something unclear. And this one is one where, fine, she actually did do something kind for someone. And if this is true, then, you know, power to her, I guess. But one of the tasks she's given by the Balinese medicine man is to transcribe his notes, which are written in the Balinese script, which she doesn't read. So this is clearly not actual work he needs done. This is like a meditative exercise for her. But she just cheats at this exercise chore. She goes to a photocopier place, photocopies it, puts it in a nice fucking type A binder nerd leather bound thing, and this medicine man says, "You fixed me." What the fuck?
With technology.
She is, not only is she God, she's also the Messiah that fulfills God's promise, because everyone she touches, her life is improved by. Oh, yeah.
So yeah, that wraps up our themes. We'll do a couple more bits here. We were thinking about a version of Eat, Pray, Love, but the countries she goes to are not appropriate.
Yeah, just Eat, Pray, Love in worse countries.
So maybe she learns how to eat in England.
In England.
Yeah. Yeah, boiled beans on toast. Really changed my life.
Ordering from the menu and she's like, bangers and mash.
To pray, probably, like, you know, Norway or Finland.
Yeah. That was my first guess, was like, go to Sweden or something, somewhere where everyone is blonde and they blink in unison. But then I had an idea, is like, no, she should go to like uphill Appalachia. She should start becoming a snake handler. She should get some of that like speaking in tongues, old time religion up there, or just like a Protestant megachurch.
Yeah, I mean, her religion becomes American capitalism and she reads Rich Dad, Poor Dad every day.
And obviously the worst country for lovers is Switzerland.
Yeah, I was thinking either Switzerland. Yeah.
Instead of speaking to a prophetic medicine man, she just speaks to an actuary who's like, you'll probably live about 78 years. You know?
Statistically speaking.
Yeah, you'll likely have 2 divorces, 1 short, 1 long. Yeah, just based on statistics.
Lizzie Gilbert, I hooked up with this guy in Switzerland, and when he fucked me, it was like a watchmaker. Boom, boom, boom. Probably because he was an actual watchmaker. Yeah, I think this movie would be much, much, much better if we rewrote the ending so that she converted to Islam.
Yeah.
And the last words when the title card comes up for the wine mom in Eat, Pray, Love is just the 6 words you need to say earnestly to convert. So yeah, closing thoughts. This movie is bad. This book is bad.
The movie is the greatest movie I've ever seen in my life. After I watched the movie, I immediately started reading the book and I started imagining myself doing what she did. I was like, I'm picking the date in my head when I can take a year off to travel around the world. But then I remembered that I can't financially do this. And so first my fantasy was me making a bunch of money somehow. Then the fantasy would begin. So it actually required 2 fantasies in my head, which I think is basically necessary for everybody. But it's impossible to read this book and not be like, I would be so fixed if I went to Italy and I started speaking Italian and eating good food. And then I went and meditated. Like,
and then I found a rich Spanish man or Brazilian man to fall in love with.
So that's basically my 18-month plan at this point. Is
remember in Scarface, we just gotta tweak it. First you get the money, then you get the self-actualization, then you become God. So if you joined us for this episode, if you made it to the end, I know this is not usually the kind of stuff we do. Thank you so much. Like I always say, like, subscribe, give us 5 stars, follow us on Twitter. And if you are just jonesing for more Remember Shuffle content, we post on the podcast player apps a couple days before it goes up on the YouTube. So be sure to subscribe to us there.
And if you're listening on YouTube right now, Big Tech has suppressed our Dane Cook episode from being shown on YouTube. So if you are interested in that, please check that out on a podcast player, because I had a lot of fun with that one. So I think it's worth listening to. And there's a secret surprise after the closing credits song. So check that out.
As always, big thanks to our expert guests, Franca and Andrea.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure being here.
Andrea, I'm sure we'll have you back on the pod at some point.
I thought that you might be very torn reviewing this movie because it's such a crazy cartoonization of Italy. But the things that it's saying are generally good things. Did you have a hard time being like, maybe she's right, actually. Italy is this heavenly land of milk and honey.
Italy's hell. But we'll talk about it another time.
Okay.
All right. So I guess it is the time to say arrivederci.
Arrivederci.
Attraversiamo.
Attraversiamo.
Ciao, ciao.